It is a dark time in the galaxy. Star Wars: The Last Jedi reigns supreme in the box office and in the public discourse. Meanwhile, across the galaxy,
the dynamic duo of Marshall and Steven still themselves for a moment and prepare for the final battle. But also, we learn of a darker side, of war, of death, of deception. Stay tuned for this week's episode.
Hey, I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
This is Androids and Assets. And this week, it's Star Wars Month, Part 3. We have seen Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, so you don't have to. If you do want to see it, though, and you want to go in spoiler-free, you should stop listening to this podcast right now. We're going to talk about everything that we saw. No holds barred. It's all fair game.
All right, so just to start off, I wanted to give us kind of like a brief kind of description of what we do here. We just really got on Google Play, and so I'm hoping maybe for some of you this might be your first episode. So one of the things I want to talk about, Androids and Assets, fundamentally is about thinking about how, in much the way science fictions might teach us to think differently about technologies and ways of viewing the world, it also gives us messages about politics and about economics and society in general. Because all of these future worlds are also theoretical societies. And often those are quite heavily infused with the beliefs about what an ideal or a terrible society would look like. And we don't think that's any different than in Star Wars. So I think moving forward, as we have in the past, we're really trying to stick to kind of what is the theoretical society? What is this trying to teach us? And we're not really interested in doing conventional film criticism. And we're not here to tell you what you should watch, what you shouldn't want, what's a good movie, what's a bad movie. I think there's a lot of interesting things to say about some very, very terrible movies. From there, I think that's what we're going to be doing here. We're really going to be getting into what is Star Wars saying about society and wealth and power. And not so much about what it was valued as a movie. Because I think some of the things that the critical film side of me thinks were really terrible from a narrative perspective in Star Wars Episode 8 were actually some of the most interesting and rich parts socially.
Yeah, and I think I agree with that.
And I think we can maybe talk about one of those parts now. We can maybe just jump into that even.
Jump right into it. Yeah, absolutely. Canto Bite. This is the planet. It's a rich world where Finn and Rose travel.
It's basically a 20s planet.
It's a 20s planet.
They go to a roaring 20s planet, and all the people do there is be in the raging 20s. They wear tuxedos and avant-garde dresses and dance to jazz and drink.
And abuse children.
And abuse children at the race, yeah, and have a child slavery there.
So it was the 20s.
So they go to this roaring 20s planet, Great Gatsby world. It's a super weird part of the movie because it's part of this whole digression that goes nowhere. But I think it's one of the most interesting and rich settings.
Yeah. It really opens up Star Wars providing a bit of a class critique, which is something I don't think Star Wars has really done in the past. So Rose said that she grew up in a planet very similar to this, not necessarily Canto Bight, where her and her sister were poor and abused children that the rich just took advantage of because there was no one there to protect them. They end up encountering children like this, revealing that they're from the Resistance. And the children welcome them with open arms because the Resistance is apparently associated with a democratizing force, freedom from slavery, and a better life for these children. Which, I mean, these are all great things. I just kind of go back to the prequels where that the Republic existed and these were still problems.
It's largely indifferent to slaves.
Yeah. Whether it's accurate or not could be something. But at least the poor people are saying, well, we know the First Order is bad. And the people that are taking advantage of us are quite satisfied and happy with the First Order. So
we're going to the worst part of the universe, the most wretched hive of scum and villainy, like it's a taken out line. But instead of going to a CD bar, they go to a super classy and expensive casino.
Yes.
And that, you know, that's nice. That's fun. That kind of takes a Star Wars trope and turns it on its head. But more importantly, it is actually, yeah, I think it's kind of the first time, and a rare exception to which a denunciation of the 1%. Before we go too far, and, you know, pinning ribbons to this and saying this is such a great thing, that's also a super vague and easy target. Particularly as we get down to the bottom of, like, well, why are these people so wealthy? And it's kind of, again, a throwaway line. It's just like, oh, the reason everyone's so rich is because of the war. These are all arms dealers.
Yeah.
Which is a super easy criticism take. Well, of course I'm against people who made their money selling arms and perpetrating a war. No one's saying, well, these are investment people who took away people's homes or, you know, stuff like that. Or that it's just a broad cross-section of the capitalist class. They have to be a very particular type of rich person who's become wealthy doing a very particular type of ethically dubious action. So it's got limits in its power as a criticism. And there's something you said that was very, very potent as well, which is also this notion that kind of Finn is initially horrified by this, but he kind of gets... He meets someone who kind of leads him by the hand and kind of shows him another way of looking at this.
Yeah, so they encounter, they're thrown in prison, encounter DJ, encounter a slicer who has a very fluid view of the world, that everything is just business, it's just a deal, there's no good, there's no bad, everything is gray. And they're on a stolen ship, and at first...
Fleeing Cantabite.
Yeah, fleeing Cantabite. They're on a stolen ship, and... At first, Finn is horrified of the ship, and like, you stole this? How could you have done that? Which, I mean, in retrospect, sort of makes sense. Finn was indoctrinated by an authoritarian capitalist order.
Finn's a Kantian.
he's going to, you know, value property rights. So I can understand kind of where he's coming from. I don't know that I agree with him, you know. When you're going to be killed or you're going to get rescued in a stolen ship, don't worry so much that the ship was stolen. You got rescued. They look at the manifest or the order history of this ship and they say, well, let's see how he got so rich. And they pull up these orders and there's some TIE fighters and some walkers of some sort, AT-STs or AT-ATs, whatever. Or
the really extra big AT-ATs, because AT-ATs weren't big enough.
Selling stuff that was clearly for the First Order, and as they're scrolling through, eventually they come to an X-Wing, and DJ says, oh, so he also sold to your side. Maybe he's not such a bad guy after all. I'm like, no! He's a fucking bad guy! You can't say, oh, I sold weapons to both sides, so I'm not a bad guy. If you're willing to sell weapons to the First Order, and they're going to commit atrocities with them, as we've witnessed them do, that makes you a bad guy. You can't say, oh, well, I sold them to the people who are also going to try and stop atrocities, so it's kind of okay.
I was an equal opportunity atrocity supplier.
It's just wrong. I could understand if they said he was morally ambiguous because he only sold weapons to the Resistance. Then you could say, well, you know, we're not a big fan of war, but at least he was only selling them to the people who were trying to prevent atrocities. But it wasn't even that.
Well, again, it starts with this really strong critique, like, here are these wealthy people living in the middle of this war, you know, benefiting from this incredibly repressive regime. And then as the scene goes on, there's all these qualifications tacked on. Well, they're rich, but they're rich because they did this. Well, no. And then it's like, well, at the end, let's not blame the weapons. I don't think we should blame the guns, right? Guns are irrelevant, you know.
AT-ATs don't kill people. Yeah. People kill people.
People driving AT-ATs kill people. Exactly, yeah. So
when I was watching the credits, though, I didn't notice any funding from the NRA, so I was a little bit surprised to see that their messaging got right into the thick of the movie.
So Cantabite was, for us, I think, one of the most, I mean, clearly, it's most showing about kind of what the Star Wars universe is and kind of how its dynamics and its politics work. And you see very clearly that kind of draws this line between the wealth, the powerful elites of the whatever galaxy we're in and the First Order, that there actually is some consensus amongst elites, and that the rebellion is a from-below movement. And it gets to this whole thing, yeah, there's these abused children who help Finn and Rose escape. At the end, one of the kids uses the Force to draw a broom to him, and he's sweeping up the stables, and he's looking out to the stars. And he has, like, a little Force, a little Rebel Alliance icon he's wearing. And you're like, oh, okay, well, the Empire's won for now, but the revolution lives on in the children.
I think he was actually wearing a Rebel Alliance decoder ring.
Which you can buy for $14.99.
The message that they were sending about that little boy. And is it Leia that says when the remainder of Resistance escapes from Kylo Ren, we're going to be the spark of the flame that burns down the First Order. So this is where the Resistance has accepted that they've lost this battle. And now they've sort of said, okay, the First Order won. The Republic is dead and the Empire is back. We're going to inspire other people to eventually take down the First Order.
that at this point the battle has become ideological and propagandistic more than military.
They've essentially taken these children and brought them into the fold and said, we're on your side and you will be on our side when the time comes. I can just imagine this boy who is now 6 or 9. He's kind of like a young Anakin, like he wasn't really involved in the galaxy, but now he gets brought into this battle that isn't really his. He's going to be 14, a Force user, probably, you know, throwing improvised explosive devices into AT-ATs, risking his life and killing other people, propagating this war on and on and on.
Except Star Wars won't do that because it will just be like, oh, things are going to change for him. That's the line that they leave you on. But they don't leave you on this thing, in this notion that, like, we're going to take that boy, we're going to use this goodwill, this experience, and put a gun in his hand and tell him to kill people with it. Particularly feeling like a person in the West for whom we see every day that through our actions globally, particularly in the United States and Canada, Canada's renewing new rounds of arms sales to Gulf regimes and Ukraine. And to notice that, you know, Canadian military equipment is going to go out and it's going to be killing fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters around the globe. The notion that all of these abuses and misdeeds are going to come back on us should not be something we are happy about. This should be a very sober reminder to us that when we kill people, those people have family members and people who cared about them and people who suffer the consequences of our hubris. And who will take efforts, as is their right and as they should, to remediate that. And this is not something we should be celebrating. This is something we should be taking home as a very potent and important lesson. On the topic of arms, I want to get into the bombing. Actually, I want to go back to the beginning of the movie now, and I'll talk about that ridiculous bombing scene. Physics of it aside, the fact that bombs don't work in space.
Well,
We're not going to get into it.
We don't have a physicist with us today, so...
There's this scene where, you know, it shows the bombs dropping out of the ship and going down and destroying the dreadnought. It goes back to this thing we talked about when we were talking with Justin about how U.S. military force doctrine, and particularly this whole joint operational thing with airstrikes supporting ground formation as being kind of like the cornerstone of American way of doing warfare, is really imported wholesale into Star Wars. And that fundamentally the heroic, definitive thing at the start of this movie was the tremendously sacrificial act of this bombing crew to deliver a deadly payload out of the sky onto their enemies. And sure, that's controversial because Leia clearly has issues with the decision moving forward. But nonetheless, it is really heroizing and valorizing this air war. And it's coding, and it's part of a long-standing tradition inside Star Wars of coding the struggle of Star Wars in a World War II kind of system, which I think is partially why you have all these sorts of, like, the physics gets displayed in a particular way because you need to simulate understandable combat environments into space. When Snoke's ship is firing, you know, the laser beams are lobbing, they're bending. More to emulate the tracking of artillery munitions, because you wouldn't want to have a too alien of a sort of warfare system. To strengthen that tie between the Second World War and to code it into a military struggle that we can understand with sides that we understand through historicity. I find this troubling.
I don't think that Star Wars necessarily is new to this idea of coding their conflict, though.
No.
You mentioned to me earlier, before we were recording, the Empire has always been coded as a fascistic regime. Before we even saw them commit any crimes or behave in terrible, terrible ways, we knew they were bad guys because of the uniforms they wore. They looked like Nazis. They were space Nazis, so they had to be bad. I think this fits in a very similar way. The battle looks like something we recognize, and so we can say, oh, I get that. Like, I understand. And I don't need a lot of exposition. I just get it. That's probably done to help the audience. But what it chooses to reinforce and how it chooses to reinforce these things, they could have made other choices.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing for me that comes up for me all the time is I'm very triggered by by depictions of bombing and air raids, and particularly anything that reinforces the sterility of these acts, that these things are not connected to massive atrocities on the ground for the people on the receiving end of those explosives, because you don't see them. And I think this is kind of a trigger for me, I think. And maybe it's not such a structural part of Star Wars, or even necessarily such a big factor of what people are taking away.
I know, at least when I saw the movie, when they did manage to blow up the dreadnought, it did receive cheers in the theater. The audience was quite pleased that these soldiers of the Empire, the First Order, had all just died. I understand sort of the sentiment, the First Order are bad dudes, but I always have trouble cheering when I see wide-scale death. There's something about it that just doesn't seem right.
Our enthusiasm for mass murder is,
like, I know Hux unsettling. Is bad, and I know Snoke is bad, and Kylo Ren is clearly evil. The leadership, yeah, they're all bad dudes. And maybe you shouldn't follow bad dudes.
But ultimately, like, Finn really had no choice. Finn was indoctrinated from birth, you know. He only got away because he got incredibly lucky. Yeah, this notion that these are all individually to a one bad people who deserve to die, and that this is a laudable fact,
yes,
is perhaps unsettling. Yeah, so interesting.
Something that we touched on last episode, we were talking about what we were hoping to sort of see in the movie, or where things might go that, you know, have bothered us before, is the Jedi and the Jedi Order. I never see the Jedi as being a force of good. Mark Hamill might disagree with me on this one. I was hoping that from the trailer we hear Luke say, it's time for the Jedi Order to end. And I was really hoping he was going to say, the Jedi Order being sort of this black and white, there is a right way and a wrong way of doing things, and that we should be removed from the world and really sort of focus more on the internal perfection of ourselves. He was going to say, you know what, that's a bunch of crap. My dad fell to the dark side because of this exact training regimen. And when I tried to institute it, my nephew also fell to the dark side. There is something fundamentally flawed about what we're offering if people are constantly at risk of falling to the dark side. Hell, Luke, when doing the training, almost fell to the dark side again. So this is like two or three brushes that he's had where he's like just about fallen, because the system that they're following doesn't actually allow for humanity.
It has too much emphasis on purity and sacredness. And so Luke wants to bring forth an iconoclast agenda, and he wants to actually destroy the sort of core notion of the Jedi, and particularly to destroy the only existing copies of their core sacred texts.
Which I found kind of exciting, until he also said, look, it's not going to kill the Force. Sure, you know, if you feel everything, the Force is everywhere. It is within every person. And Rey is like, oh yeah, it's there. And he said, so if we stop using it, it doesn't mean the Force dies. It just means no one can use it anymore. So I'm not going to train you. I'm not going to train anybody else.
It's time for those damn books.
Yeah. Which isn't just an end to the Jedi as a religion. It's an end to Force users as a whole. And that seemed problematic to me, that he was like conflating, manipulating the Force with a strict monastic order. These are two very different things. And I was really hoping that that's where Luke was going to go. He would say, look, it's time for the Jedi to end. You're coming to me because you want Jedi teachings. And I can't give you that. What I can give you is Force techniques. I can show you how to be focused. I can show you how to use what you're doing and hone your skills.
Hoping for a middle path.
A middle path would be great, where he would just sort of say, what you do with this is up to you. You can be good, you can be bad, you can be human. Ideally, you'll do the right thing with it. And I think I'm getting the sense from Rey that she would do the right thing. But I also get the sense from Rey that if something truly wrong or truly evil were happening, she would step in and prevent it. So she's not really a good Jedi either. And that passion, by following the Jedi logic, will then lead her to the dark side. And she'll have her lifetime brushes of, oh crap, am I the dark side now? Am I the dark side now? And that's just no way to live your life.
Yeah, so all of this comes to a head with Luke, and he has a showdown with Yoda's Force ghost. And he's like, should I burn it down? Should I not burn it down? And in the end, Yoda summons a lightning bolt and burns it all down. And you're like, oh, that's awesome. And you think this would be great, and it's such a powerful scene in the movie. Except, nope, didn't happen, because Rey stole the books, and they're all still out there, and none of this matters. The end. That big, powerful, emotional moment meant nothing.
It was really powerful to see Yoda come back and sort of offer Luke this, like, one last lesson, and sort of say, you know what, Luke?
Burn it down.
I was wrong. You should burn it down. The Jedi Order isn't what matters. That's not the big thing. That's not what it's all about. And it felt really nice, and Luke was, like, conflicted, and he doesn't quite burn it down, and Yoda says, I'll do it for you. Look, I care so much about you that I'll do the thing you can't do to give you a better, a healthier life.
Except, yeah, except
and then we get a sneak peek that Rey had actually gone in and stolen the books, these sacred Jedi teachings, without Luke knowing. So the order is going to continue on. And I would presume that Yoda knew that this happened. Now that it goes from being sort of a reconciliation to Yoda saying, I'm right. I've always been right. Why'd you question anything, Luke? I don't need you. There is another.
And the one kind of authentic, insightful, spiritual teaching from this Star Wars movie is lost. Completely lost and negated. The only other thing I think they just talk about is gender. In the sense that, you know, you have Poe Dameron, big gosh darn space hero, who's out there and he's brash and he fights this big battle against the Dreadnought. And he comes back and he's like, what the hell are you doing? And she demotes him and, you know, and he's like, we need action. We need to fight. We need to kill people. Ah! And the women who are actually in charge of the rebellion are just trying to desperately to rein him in. And Laura Dern's character, what's her name?
Vice Admiral Holton?
Vice Admiral Holton, yeah. And so she's like, I have a plan. He's like, you're doing nothing. And he comes up with this idiot scheme that he sends Finn and Rose on. And it's really interesting, you know, he's mansplaining to her throughout the whole thing. He's like, no, this isn't how you fight a war. What do you know? You're too nicey-nice. And she is nice. But at the end, you find out she actually has, like, she has this really brilliant plan, and it works really well, and she saves the rebellion, and Poe Dameron's a fucking idiot. But it's okay, because we like him anyway.
She even says almost that exact thing. After he mutinies, she comes in and shoots him.
Stuns him.
Stuns him. This is when Leia wakes up, resumes command. Leia is sort of like shaking her head like, damn it, Poe, when are you going to learn? I have such high hopes for you. You have natural leadership talent, but you just can't learn. And then Vice Admiral Holton is like, ah, you know, he just wants to get in there and blow stuff up. I like him.
He'll come
and
around.
Leia says, me too. You should not like him.
He's a treacherous monster who nearly foiled your plan in the middle of battle. He is a bad guy.
So I think those are the main points that we saw in the movie.
Yeah, I think, yeah. It gives us some new insight into the Star Wars universe, and particularly into warfare in the Star Wars universe, and very much hones in on the nature of the struggle as it's now defined.
Thanks for being with us. We do have one more episode still in Star Wars month. That's coming up, obviously, in 1 week. We're going to talk about where we might expect the movie to go. We have another couple movies coming out in short order. So what we might expect to see from that, what we would like to see from that, what kind of messages they may have opened themselves up to spreading to our youth.
I think we'll take this opportunity also to depart on some of the lingering questions we've had, like maybe like a little bit about credits and maybe about shipping, some of those other things. Like, how does the economy in Star Wars actually function, if at all?
We have some of those questions.
There are some grave, grave concerns.
All right. Thanks very much.
Music for this episode was brought to you by the Max Rebo Band, as well as Scandroids.
Which, by the way, why do they use any other weapon? Why do they have other guns?
If now that we know, you just need to like load up X-Wing Kamikaze. Yeah.
Point your ship at another ship. Go to light speed. You will cut it and then splinter in half. And then all adjacent ships will also be destroyed. Why would you have another weapon? Why wouldn't just ships just carry around giant, like, fucking swords with hyperdrives on the back? And they just fucking throw them off
rail the ship. Guns.
Yeah, yeah. And just cut other ships to pieces.
That would be less exciting than a laser space battle.
With shields and, yeah.